capitalism is going through a spasm caused by its own generation of technologies that undermine itself.
How can you, with a straight face, make the argument that more guns will make us safer?
We need to build a wall, and it has to be built quickly.
Hello and welcome to Level Talk Programme. I'm John Harrison. Now, thousands of nationalist and fascist demonstrators took to the streets in Warsaw on the 11th of November for their Independence Day, what is believed to be one of the largest far-right gatherings in the world this century. Now, Poland is believed to have the fifth highest number of far-right activists in the world today, behind Germany, Hungary, the Czech Republic and the United States. Now, why has Poland seen such a surge in nationalist thinking since the collapse of communism? It's a very, very big subject, but let's try and tackle this. And I'm joined by Magdalena Schmidt, a Polish lawyer and women's rights activist, and also Scott Andrews, a well-known writer, social activist, who has written, amongst other books, a novel inspired by the Smolensk tragedy called Morning, Morning. Welcome, Magdalena and Scott.
Hi. Welcome. Thank you for having me.
Now, can we put this in some sort of context, please, for listeners who don't know anything about this? How many people took part in the demonstrations on Independence Day?
60,000 people has been reported in the media.
60,000 people. That's a massive amount of people. Was this demonstration sanctioned by the powers to be?
Wow, that is actually quite a question. Factually, that this meeting has taken place every year for a number of years, and it's grown bigger and bigger.
Yeah.
Notably, the spikes with assaults and troubles and violence has been worse in the years under the current government, and also the last time they were in power. To say that in regards to it being sanctioned, one of the most troubling aspects of it is that in Warsaw, the local government is actually the opposition. This is the citizens' platform. And they have the rights to send people to watch the protest and to close it at the first sign of any criminal activity. And they have never done it to date. There's not been one monitor sent. So to say, is it endorsed? It's endorsed by all sides.
Yeah. Now, okay, this can be looked at in many, many different points of view as a sociological phenomenon, as a political aspect of modern Polish life, as a global phenomenon, a drift to the right, even to the far right. But for you, Magdalena, how serious is this? Somebody who's Polish and understands the country.
You know, there are quite thin lines between being a passionate patriot and a Nazi or a fascist. And legally, Article 13 of Polish Constitution forbids this kind of protests. But the current government, the law and justice government, sort of endorsed them even. So it is a quite difficult situation. And I do find it scary. I mean, this is what drove Poland into the ground, into the pulp in 1939, and it's happening again. So how short the memory is of the Poles at the moment. This is scary. This is scary, but I see it also in a global context.
Yeah. Okay, you're talking about a thin line between nationalism and fascism. I'd like to hear your opinion about exactly what that line is. I mean, I can tell you what my version of that is, if you don't mind. And that is when feelings turn into physical violence and retribution or violence is carried out against minority groups, be they religious, ethnic groups, whatever, political groups, doesn't matter. What is your definition of the line between nationalism and fascism?
I was talking about, thank you. I was talking about the line between patriotism and fascism nationalism. This way. For you, it's just a physical violence. When it turns into physical violence, that's where you draw the line.
Yeah. You agree with that, Scott, do you?
Yeah.
I do, and I can also give you several examples of acts of physical violence that were carried out during this protest, to which nobody has been arrested or charged for.
Yeah.
One of the biggest issues since the main political forces behind this parade are supported by the government, in the last year and a half, they've had three separate parades in Warsaw where the police have been there to protect the actual nationalists from the counter-protesters. In the last weekend, there were only 50 arrests, and they were all pro-democracy protesters.
Yeah, so it's a sort of, it's being allowed to happen, basically, in a few words. Now, can you also please help us, people who are not in Poland, don't really know much about this, can you just tell us what exactly are these demonstrators demonstrating for or against? I mean, what are they shouting? What are the logans? What are the slogans? What is their driving force? What do they want?
So, among other things, they were heard to be shouting, pure Poland, white Poland, refugees get out, pray for an Islamic Holocaust, not red, not rainbow, but national Poland.
Wow.
Poland for Polish.
Yeah.
Now, when you consider precisely what they're meant to be doing, on one hand, it is the celebration of independence, but that's a more difficult question because historically, the education system tends to ignore what happened in Europe that led to the recreation of the Polish state.
Yeah.
Which actually explains a lot about the identity, where right now, there were people chanting because they want a more authoritarian state. They want the Poland of the 1930s. They want a new republic, a fourth republic that was closer to the second republic, which was anti-Semitic, which was nationalistic, mm-hmm. which, you know, under the times of Pilsudski, there were show trials. It was a tyrannical state at that point. Mm-hmm. So for me, it defies belief that in 2017, people want a time machine to go back to a time in history where they will be oppressed.
Right.
Well, you're implying they know the history. I have my doubts about their knowledge and education,
you have to
be honest. I, you know, and they were carrying, last Sunday, they were carrying the banners saying things like white Europe of brotherly nations. What is this? This is 2017. How can you think something like that? This is horrible.
It sounds like a 1980s synth pop band.
What frightens me is that it's happening. Now, you say they all the time, and we've heard the figure 60,000. And we don't know how accurate that is. It may be more, maybe less. But what proportion of the population in Poland do these people represent? 1%, 2%, 10%, 20%? Any idea, anybody?
If you consider Poland a nation of 37 million people,
yeah,
60,000 is a drop in the ocean. Okay, it's bigger than it has been, and it's growing, and we know that many protesters join from other countries. So that this is a figure that has been inflated by almost tourist Nazis, which is...
Tourist Nazis.
You know, one of the things that you really must look at more closely when understanding why is it that a government would want to do this? Why would a government endorse this? Why would they support this? In Poland, and specifically under PiS, the Law and Justice Party, you have a great period of reductionist history to fit a romantic idea that Poland was the country that has continually been punished, continually been a martyr throughout history. Some wonderful examples when you think this protest ended on Pilsudski Square,
yeah.
The man who brought show trials to Poland. They passed by the Ronda Domowski, the roundabout dedicated to Roman Domowski.
Mm-hmm.
He was a massive anti-Semite, all-round bigot and quite deplorable man. And he has a monument to him. And mm-hmm. you look through the last it was about 2.5 years under the same party. They were placing statues to a variety of anti-Semites. They've reduced history to an us-against-them mentality to fit their national idea.
Okay, when we have demonstrations anywhere in the world, obviously the amount of people who are actually on the streets demonstrating is not the total amount of people who support a particular cause. Now, the 60,000 people that you're talking about, do you think that sort of represents 10%, 20%, and also what strata of society? We're talking about younger people, educated people, non-educated people, immigrants, whoever. Can you give me any more details, please? Magdalena.
Thank you. As I've mentioned before, I have my doubts on the knowledge of history,
yeah.
of modern history of Poland. Not even that modern. I mean, we've been partitioned for longer than a century.
Yeah.
And it was not that long ago. We celebrate the 11th of November as the Independence Day because in 1918 we were a country again. And we've been erased from the map as a country for more than 120 years. So I'm not sure whether these people know the history. I cannot give you the exact profile of supporters of people who were marching last Sunday.
Right.
But I do have my doubts on their education, and they are brainwashed. These people are brainwashed.
Okay.
That's what I think.
It could be a very small number of the general population. You could be talking about 1 or 2%. You could be talking about people being bussed in from outside the city, from the countryside, as you said, people coming in from abroad. It doesn't necessarily mean that this is a mass movement in Poland then.
So hard to say. When you consider 95% of Poles identify themselves as Catholic.
Yeah.
And how involved the Catholic organizations and the Catholic churches in perpetuating these false ideals. It's difficult. You know, I was quite surprised by some of the beliefs and opinions that people have.
Yeah.
What you do see is a lot of disenfranchised men who believe that they've been left behind by Europe, that they were always inferior, and now they're being given an enemy, they're being given a motivation, and they're being given the means. I want to touch on one point that Magda said. Mm-hmm. She was referring to the partitions of Poland and how Poland disappeared from the map. Classically, this is given an example of Polish romanticism. Mm-hmm. I remember living in Poland and I'd heard this so much. And one day I went to the King's Palace in Warsaw. And when you do a tour of the art collection there, they have a wonderful painting of Catherine the Great signing the second partition with three Polish noblemen who not a single Pole I've ever met was aware that Poles signed the partition of Poland, that they participated. And the reason for it is the romanticism of Poland. Poland, the Jesus Christ. They dismiss anything that they've done. And this is, again, partially due to being a Catholic society where you can commit the greatest sin, on Sunday apologize for it, and on Monday do it again.
Yeah, it's fascinating. It's a whole new angle on this whole thing. And I'm wondering if that is actually a really valid reason. And in fact, my next question was going to be with trying to tackle this whole issue and bring in religion and sort of suggest that perhaps Christianity is being used as a sort of identity marker around which people can gather. And I'd like to ask you whether the demonstrators were referring to religious symbolism and using their faith as a sort of rallying cry, and as you mentioned, anti-Semitism against the non-Christians. Well, you can't really say that Judaism is not a Christian experience, but you can use it, of course, when you're talking about the Islamic faith.
One of the most popular slogans at the protest was, "We want God." This was a promo public stunt that Donald Trump referred to in the speech, in this sense that they do feel a validation. But I genuinely don't believe it's a question of being Christian. It's a question of the idea that being a nationalist, being a patriot in their convoluted idea, means that they're better than the West. It's about the identity versus the atheists, identity versus the Jews, identity versus the foreigners. To them, it is us nationalists versus everybody else.
Yeah, okay. Well, you're disturbing me. Let's take a short break here.
Capitalism is going through a spasm caused by its own generation of technologies that undermine itself.
How can you, with a straight face, make the argument that more guns will make us safer?
We need to build a wall, and it has to be built quickly.
Welcome back to Level Talk Programme. My name is John Harrison. Under discussion in today's programme are the demonstrations which took place in Poland on November the 11th. Magdalena Schmidt, a Polish lawyer and women's rights activist, and Scott Andrews, a well-known writer, expert on Poland and social activist, take part in this programme. Now, we basically just got on to the subject of the connection between religion and I guess, nationalism. And it's frightening, isn't it? Because that part of Europe was, of course, used as the physical location of the concentration camps where a large number of Jews were exterminated during what we call the Second World War. And, I mean, how can it be, that? And Magdalena, you've already answered the question because you said that many Poles have not studied history. But how can it be that on the territory of that country, you're seeing this phoenix of fascism rise up again? It's, to me, it's incalculable. It's ununderstandable. I can only presume that this is a linked with politics. It's to do with the popularistic nature of the current government. Is that something to do with it, Magdalena? Help me out here.
Yes, this is actually today a plenary debate at the European Parliament took place on Poland and the breaching of the European law and the rule of law in specifics. And there were some European Parliament members who raised the subject that, actually what happened Sunday in Warsaw, this 60,000 fascists and Nazis marching, it happened actually 300 kilometers from Auschwitz-Birkenau concentration camp.
Yeah.
And this is weird. This is really weird. I think it's scary, but I do not fully understand it either. What are the sociological reasons for people in Poland to be this way? I know for sure that there is the ruling party, the Law and Justice Party, that supports them, or maybe not supports them, but that allows them to do so. So that's the current political climate that I would blame for it.
Yeah, I mean,
they've always these organizations that were marching and organizing the marches on Sunday, they've been there for a while. It's not like, you know, like they exist for a week. Today on the radio, one of the leaders of one of these organizations, ONR, that's the nationalist, he was very, very upset about the fact that some people dared to say anything about the fact that that they were Nazis or fascists. He said, "We were there with our children, so it's nonsense." So, you know, and I mean, it scares me. People take children to this kind of protest.
Yeah, and you mentioned people coming in from Hungary and what other countries are coming in to take part?
You had Tommy Robinson from the UK, who is a very famous fascist. You had a leader of England First. You had Roberto Fiore in Italy, who was once wanted for arrest there. I can't recall whether it was Holocaust denial specifically. You had members of the Jobbik party in Hungary. I also would like to mention there was a similar mass demonstration in Wrocław, where a priest who's been excommunicated for his anti-Semitic views, he has been refused entry to the UK twice, was the lead speaker, along with a guy who was sent to prison for burning the effigy of a Jew, who the president's office intervened and let him out. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so in a way, East Europe now is being used as a sort of vocal mouthpiece for far-right people who would not be able to do that sort of thing at home, wherever home may be. They, you know, at least not this side of the Atlantic. This is very interesting, isn't it? And I'm wondering, you know, what the EU is now going to do, because they've had these problems with the repression of the Polish legal system, and now there's something else coming up. And I mean, you wonder, if I was in Brussels, would I just want to get rid of Poland? I mean, we've had enough of them, you know. Or is the Polish disease, if you like, now so deeply embedded in East Europe and it's sort of spreading to other countries, they can't isolate Poland. They can't separate it from the similar things that are happening in other East European countries.
First of all, I would not call it a Polish disease. There are similar sympathies, if you please, let's call it this way, spreading all over the Europe. We know Le Pen in France and Pegida in Germany and PVV, Geert Wilders, PVV in the Netherlands. And you've got also what Scott just mentioned, you've got these sentiments also in the UK, in Greece, and everywhere in Europe. So I would not say that it's a Polish disease. However, it's actually a very good timing of this program. This morning, the European Parliament had a plenary session on Poland. Yes, so they are planning to practically invoke and trigger Article 7 procedure on breaching of the rule of law. There's been a draft of the resolution filed by five parliamentary groups at the parliament.
Yeah.
And I have no idea what the result of the voting is, because they've just voted.
Yeah.
So that's a serious thing, and that's a third resolution against Poland on this matter. So, you know, it's...
You say that it's not a Polish disease, but okay, I mean, nobody else, no country in the world, you know, has seen a demonstration of 60,000 people on that country's Independence Day, you know, of people shouting those sort of slogans. I mean, it is unique.
This is unique and it's scary and this is huge.
Yeah, it's huge. Yeah,
that's true. Yeah.
Okay, Scott, you're going to say something about
that. The issue here, more than anything else, aside from the content of the demonstration, is what we spoke about at the beginning of the program. The fact that the Polish government endorses this. And how do we know this? The Minister for Internal Affairs is quoted as saying it was a beautiful sign of Poles regaining their priorities. Television Polska, the national TV station, described it as a great march of patriots, ordinary Poles expressing their love of Poland. Mm. So on TVP, they interviewed one protester who said the only demand they've got is to remove Jewry from power. Now, a few weeks before, there was a rosary protest in Poland, which involved 320 churches encouraging people to pray all around the borders of Poland to keep immigrants out. You have examples of a woman who went to St. Barbara's Church, where before the protest, there was a mass for the most fascist organization, this ONR, the National Radical Camp.
Yeah,
and she was unveiling a banner, had a quote from John Paul, saying that racism is a sin. The women from Strike Kobiet and the citizens group, they, in their counter-protest, they unveiled a banner and they were physically assaulted by protesters, and the police stood by and watched.
Yeah.
This is a government-sponsored, state-sponsored fascist rally. And that, to me, is why Europe has to move now.
Yeah. Has this been influenced by President Trump's visit to Poland? I mean, does the party in power feel somewhat sort of endorsed by the Americans? Has that been a significant factor? I don't want to place blame on the Americans. That's not my intention. But I do think it's rather a coincidence somehow that these things are happening after President Trump's visit.
It's a question of an opinion leader validating an opinion by the people he chose to meet there, by the speech he made. He has endorsed their position. In a similar way that Jarosław Kaczynski, when he publicly stated that we can't accept Muslim immigrants because they carry parasites, endorsed that as a socially acceptable opinion. And this is the dynamic that has changed under this last government. Now it's okay to be xenophobic, to be homophobic, to be racist, because people in public office actively endorsing it. Another wonderful example, a few weeks ago, the president of Poland gave an award to a historian who wrote a book that actually said World War II wasn't that bad for the Jews.
Yeah.
That's the highest office in Poland. Under the last PiS government, they gave the education ministry to Roman Giertych, who was the leader of the League of Polish Families, which also had a paramilitary fascist organization under their umbrella. His father was a Euro MP who published a pamphlet in the name of the European Union that said, well, Jews actually wanted to live in ghettos in the Second World War. And under their last time in office and this time in office, you see a spike in intolerance. You see a spike in fascist ideology for the simple reason that opinion leaders are validating people's opinion.
Yeah, but okay, I mean, I hear what you're saying, but for that to happen at all means that there must have been all these years that we just didn't think about it. We weren't aware of it. We didn't want to know, perhaps, when reports came through and the reports weren't very well publicized, that there still was an underlying nationalistic, stronger than nationalistic feeling within Poland. And what's happened then now is that the political, under the current political situation, those feelings are being allowed, almost being encouraged to come out, but without a basic already existing cultural, if you will, whatever you call it, trend. I don't believe that you could have had such a powerful spike materializing in such a short time. Magdalena.
You know, I think that that's in every country, that every country has got a group of liberals and left-wing people and right-wing people. I think it's everywhere. And I think that the Polish government is just bringing it up in the people at this moment, you know, if you wish, this kind of behavior, this kind of ideology. But I think that's everywhere in the world. And it's got this, it's also a global trend, so it's, you know, these two things are, you know, making it visible, making it possible, making it, yeah, come out of all the corners where they've been sitting for all this time since the Second World War.
Yeah, and the way it's being done is just that they're not being forbidden. That's it, isn't it? I mean, that's all that's happening. The only action the government is...
There is no reaction to their doing by the Polish government, by the current government, which is a contrary behavior towards the Polish government, is how the Polish government is treating women's rights groups and anti-protesters. So that's I think that that's the doing of the government, actually, that incorrect them.
And I guess that on a previous program you said, I think both of you said, that the Polish economy is actually not doing that badly. But you also said on this program that, in a way, Poland's a little being left behind. And I suppose that it's possible to use this vehicle of blaming foreigners, blaming immigrants for Poland's economic problems. That's also a common trick, isn't it? I think the same thing, we see the same thing in Catalonia and other places when the people are striving for sort of nationalistic causes.
Absolutely right, in the sense that you have this great disenfranchisement and you have government figures who are projecting our problems. Like that Europe's problem is Muslims, it's refugees. They were calling the Islamic Holocaust. Do you know how many refugees from the Middle East actually had their applications accepted last year?
In Poland? No, I don't.
18.
18, right.
It would be the quickest Islamic Holocaust in history.
Yeah. And what would be the norm in Poland sort of, you know, 5 years ago?
Obviously, you know, Poland's changed a great deal at a rapid pace. And that also frightens people. But I can recall living in Poland like 13, 14 years ago, where you would rarely see someone of a different skin tone in Warsaw. Now it is much more homogenous, but obviously it's clear it has a long way to go.
Okay, final question, because we've run out of time. I think the main question that listeners would be interested in is to find out is how far is this going to go? Are we actually going to have physical attacks on the streets of Warsaw, of Polish towns, cities, on coloured people? My first question...
Happening.
Yeah, you've already said that there were some attacks during the demonstration, but I'm not talking about just the demonstration, I'm talking about everyday life, you know.
Even prior to the demonstration, I remember around a year ago, a professor was attacked on a bus for speaking German on a telephone.
Yeah.
A few months ago, it was a black boxer in Warsaw, who was actually born in Poland, spoke fluent Polish, had an axe put in his head by some football fans. You know, these aren't isolated incidents. I know in my time living there, last time Law and Justice was in power, the actual frequency where even white Englishmen were attacked. In my own personal experience, I was attacked for looking Jewish, speaking German, which I don't, speak in English, reading in English.
Right.
I can recall possibly the weirdest of all was an old lady who actually spat on me because I was speaking English on a telephone on a tram. These are experiences that are common to any foreigner that has lived in Poland for a prolonged period of time.
You're not distorting, exaggerating things, are you? Trying to make a point out of this. I mean, you're recording life as it really is, Magdalena.
Yes, there are incidents happening not only during the Nazi and fascist protests. There are incidents happening on the public transportation in Warsaw, and it's happening already, and it scares the bejesus out of me.
All right.
It's horrible.
It's frightening. Okay, I think we have to stop the program. I think you both made your point very clearly. I thank you very much for joining us today. Magdalena Schmidt, Polish law and women's rights activist, and Scott Andrews, well-known writer and expert on Poland.
Thank you, John.
Thank you very much. Listeners have been with us today on this, listening to this rather sad program. Tune in again next week. Goodbye.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR, Community Public Radio. I'm your host, Don DeBar.
Up next, World Insight from China's Global Television Network with Tian Wei.
The Zimbabwean military has seized the control of the country and detained President Mugabe. Will this present an opportunity for Zimbabwe's opposition parties?
In this episode of Travelogue, we explore Guangzhou on the Pearl River Delta. We'll discover how family clans shaped this city's fortunes, and how the spirit of change turned it into a modern-day economic powerhouse.
From emerging powers to expanding partnerships, from fighting poverty to combating climate change, booming economies, war-ravaged nations, and everything in between. We capture the changes affecting the most dynamic and diverse continent on the planet, taking you beyond the headlines to the people and their stories. Asia Today, delivering Asia to the world.
We have come a long way. Changes happen, and fast, from all corners, different lives, voices, and visions.
We can do
this! Not letting it...
Encouraged to think, enlightened to change. World Insight with Tian Wei go beyond the headlines. Welcome back. You're still watching World Insight with me, Tian Wei, coming to you Monday to Friday on CGTN.
Zimbabwe's military seized the control of the country and confined President Mugabe and his wife early on Wednesday, saying the act was targeting criminals around the president. The country's ruling party and the African Union made a joint statement on their social media platforms, stating daily life has returned to normal under the current situation. Indeed, the crisis has not disrupted the lives of the Zimbabweans. A few roads are still under military control, but traffic in the capital, Harare, is back to normal. Let's take a look at the latest.
It is hard to say whether the recent political upheaval is the ancient grudge between 93-year-old Robert Mugabe and his obedient aide of 40 years, Emmerson Mnangagwa, or if it's the consequences of an unbalanced relationship between government and military. After being sacked as vice president and dismissed from the parliament this week, Mnangagwa decided to snap back, and quickly. He called in a favor from his close ally in the army, Defense Force Commander General Constantino Chiwenga, and put the president in house arrest on Wednesday. Another key figure at the center of the storm is the president's second wife, Grace Mugabe, who depends solely on her husband's support in her political ambitions. Grace is not very respected among Zimbabweans, but she has shown great confidence in getting elected as vice president as soon as her husband survived the little bump. Mugabe himself is also running for the 2018 elections, despite being under house arrest. Looking back on his rule of almost four decades, Mugabe seems to have a way of getting out of political turmoil. In the 2008 elections, Mugabe's ZANU-PF party lost its parliamentary majority. He was defeated by opposition leader Morgan Tsvangirai in the presidential vote. Mugabe was forced to form a power-sharing government and named his rival as prime minister. But Tsvangirai never managed to dent ZANU's dominance. In 2013, Mugabe's party abolished prime minister's post and passed a new constitution. But the recent political crisis has given the opposition hope again, and they're planning to continue their democratic campaigns once Mugabe is out of the picture.
And for more on Zimbabwe's political crisis, we are joined by Mr. Mwenda Bijiwe in Nairobi. He is the security consultant and CEO of Eye on Security. Meanwhile, we're also joined in the studio in Washington and Beijing, Ms. He Wenping, professor at the Chinese Academy of Social Sciences, and also in Washington, D.C., Emerald Woods, associate fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies. It's a consultant and strategist from the International Working Group, Africa's Rising for Justice, Peace and Dignity. A very long title, but I hope we would help our viewers know better about your background. Let me go to you, Mr. Bijiwe, first, about the latest situation in Zimbabwe. What do you say? Is it a political struggle, or is it a different way of looking for a different future of the country?
I think Zimbabwe has come, around the circle of revolution, and the country has gone through a lot of stress, especially in the last decade. But I think the leadership of Zimbabwe, especially as was accorded by military leaders and supported by the political class that believes the nation should move forward, I think they took a proper decision to decide that, hey, it's time to help President Mugabe to retire. And as you know, they said it's not a military coup, so let's not call it so.
All right.
And they said it's helping deal with the criminals. So they brought the right decision on the table.
We're going to have the others to comment about that. But what they say is not necessarily going to be the fact, as everybody would accept, whether it's a coup or not. Some say it has all the symptoms of it. Others suggest, well, it's an issue that the country has to deal with yourself. But having said that, though, does a change of a leadership at the very top, for example, not President Mugabe, but the vice president coming back to office, necessarily going to change the future of the country for the better? Mr. Bijiwe?
What I think is, you see, the handlers of President Mugabe might not have understood the intrinsic relationship between the regime of Mugabe and the military. Mm. And when they removed the vice president, then they made a miscalculation, because this is the man that had been holding you know, together the military, because looking at the strain, political strain that Zimbabwe has gone through under, you know, top class, world class discipline that the military has maintained in Zimbabwe, yeah. Then you wonder who has been able to control the military. And so removing the deputy president was a great miscalculation on the type, on the side of the handlers of the president.
Yeah.
And therefore you saw the reaction was fast and furious from the military. And the same man they removed from deputy presidency is going to assume the presidency now.
Of course, the military has been controlling the country. The vice president has been in a very close relationship with the military. But when the military is more in power or back in power, when the vice president is back in power, does it mean the country is getting better? We do not know about that. Having said that, though, Mr. Bijiwe, I want to ask you another question, which is concerning the economy of the country. We see a country that has been rising out of independence movement that should be congratulated from all over the world. However, over the past few decades, the economy not doing well at all. The high inflation, we all know. And meanwhile, there's also so-called the second revolution going on in the country, taking away the properties of the white farms and not necessarily going to the hands of those who need it, but rather to the what they call ruling class. So what will all of this mean for the future, particularly if there is a change at the top leadership?
If you listen to the statement that the military made, where they said previously, that is on the 13th of November, that was, I would call it the first shot that they made to changing the regime. They said, we are, you know, cognizant of the revolutionaries and the people that brought the revolution, and they said to protect the revolution that brought freedom to Zimbabwe in the early 80s, we are going to do anything as the military to protect that revolution. So if you look at the statements that the military has made, they are more nationalistic. That is why you look at, you see the calmness in the country. The citizenry are not revolting. There has not been any demonstrations or anyone saying, no, we don't like the change.
Okay.
Looks like everyone is agreeing with the military that this is nationalism that we need to hold the country together, but to move the country forward by changing the political leaders. And I think President Mugabe really, really made a miscalculation in his leadership. He failed to know when to leave the stage. And it's bad that his sons had to remind him when to leave the stage.
I see. Mwanda Bijiwe, coming from the Eye on Security from Nairobi. Thank you so much, sir, for joining us. Thank you. Really appreciate it. Let me go to the other two panelists. You've been attentively listening to Mr. Bijiwe earlier. Of course, your time to talk about your thoughts. Ms. Woods, you are coming to us in Washington. I wondered what are the views there, and also, how would that necessarily, the current development, help us to understand the future of and the nature of change in Zimbabwe? Ms. Woods.
Well, I think the first thing we have to say clearly is that this is a coup in Zimbabwe. And what you have seen from the African Union, from the Southern Africa Regional Group, SADC, is a real concern because these bodies, by mandate, do not seat governments that come to power through military coup. So this is a coup, we should call it that, and that's clear.
All right.
But what you also see is a level of real kind of a wait and see attitude in the streets of Zimbabwe, and you have not seen the opposition leaders speaking out, the trade union leaders, the faith-based leaders, those that you know will be watching this situation quite closely, are a bit, you know, behind the scenes at the moment.
Uh-huh.
But I suspect we will see that in the coming days. I think when it comes to Zimbabwe, you know, the US and the UK have played often a detrimental role, wanting to bring about regime change from the outside. And I think clearly what you have in Zimbabwe is a highly educated citizenry that is really focused on maintaining a future of stability for the country that brings economic well-being for all, that also gives Zimbabweans an opportunity to choose their leaders freely and hold those leaders accountable. So I think you will see in the coming days much more commentary, particularly from those forces inside the country, as they they watch to see what takes place with the negotiations that are currently underway within the country now with countries neighboring like South Africa.
Ms. He, right now there are those coming into the country of Zimbabwe. For example, the South African delegation is there. Meanwhile, the African Union is watching very closely. There's also something called the South African Regional Community who are watching this situation very closely. Of course, they will have a say about what to do with Zimbabwe from their perspective on the issue of bilateral relations and regional relations. But within Zimbabwe, what do you think are the forces that's likely to decide the future of that country?
Of course, the first job they need to do is to consolidate this event, these consequences. For example, I have heard that Robert Mugabe himself now refused to step down.
No.
He still regarded himself as the president, even though now a special envoy delegation has been sent from South Africa all the way to meet him. So the struggle, it seems, still going on. Mm. But I don't think from the side of the Mugabe and his wife, they have this kind of capacity or have this kind of power to re-win this trend.
Right.
So it seems they have already out of their historical picture. So the same for the new emerging leader. I think they need, first of all, they need to explain what's going on about this to AU and to South Africa.
That's right. Otherwise, they have sanctions against the country who are having military coup, and they wouldn't accept them into the decision-making process for the region anymore.
Yeah, because AU has the principle there. They have to make it things equal to every country. You cannot say you are not coup and other countries.
That's true.
Yeah. So they have to make it clear, saying what's going wrong in this country, what kind of right thing you have been doing, because they are saying they are bringing the country now to the right track. It seems before it's in the wrong track. So what's wrong? So they
and what are the right tracks that they are talking
about? Yeah, this is
what
they need to do. So first, get those sympathy and all those recognition from especially laboring countries and
you
the
see,
AU.
At this point, Ms. He, other countries in the other parts of the world, including the UK and the US, as Ms. Woods earlier mentioned, are quite restrained from openly commenting about the nature of the incident taking place in Zimbabwe. Is it about giving Zimbabwe a chance to figure it out on its own so that the people there would believe that they are holding their own fate? Mm-hmm. Or is it about some of behind the scenes going on that would eventually have an impact into the country?
I think both, maybe. They have now very complicated thinking right now. First of all, because all the events in Zimbabwe come in a sudden way. So this is out of people's expectation. Because all those similar stories has been taken place before. But it seems Robert Mugabe can always resolve all those crises ahead of him. But this time around, and then he failed. So even for those Western countries, they need to take some time to digest this story. They also don't know very well about this new leader, that's deputy president.
We do not know whether he will be the new leader either.
Yes.
Even though there were proposals coming from the military.
And also not so clear about his policy
and
his attitude towards East or the West country. So that needs time. And another consideration probably maybe because they have been regarded Robert Mugabe as the dictator for a long time. They want him go. If in a very short time they cheer up, which sounds like okay, maybe this is a thing you have been dreamed for, you have been even walked behind, so they want to get rid of that, keep some distance from this kind of accusation.
Interesting. Having said that though, Ms. Woods, the figure, the personality, and the character of Robert Mugabe is an extremely thought-provoking one. I mean, he was the leader in the guerrilla war against the colony. And he won the support of the country as a result of that, and also his respect of the international community, particularly from the developing economies. But then as time goes by, you see a man in power has been doing things that not necessarily going to concur with his previous image. What do you make of that?
Without a doubt, we have Robert Mugabe as the liberation leader. He is someone who is seen as having brought his country out of the racist apartheid regime. Remember, you know, it was first called Rhodesia, controlled by the British, and had a British, you know, Ian Smith ruling the country. And so you had a liberation force and a liberation leader in Mugabe that essentially ousted minority white rule in Rhodesia, what was then Rhodesia, renamed right. it to Zimbabwe, and brought liberation to the people. You also had an international community, particularly the UK and the US, really renege on promises of liberation, promises to, in one case, to help fund land reform measures within Zimbabwe, and those promises were not kept, the resources were not provided as were agreed under the discussions for independence of Zimbabwe. So you had the international community, geopolitical actors not doing their part and not right. being good citizens to some extent in that regard. So I think what you had was a quick kind of positioning of the, particularly the US and the UK, in opposition to Mugabe over the last few years, and a real fissure with the international community. So I think there's been a lot of stigmatization of Robert Mugabe. Some of it is warranted with the human rights violations, particularly in the 2008 elections and post-elections. Mm-hmm. But some of it really, you know, those who were the supporters of Mugabe in the liberation period see as a bit unfair in that the international community didn't play its part in the post-independence era.
Ms. He, there are enormous amount of comparison that you would read in the media between Mr. Mugabe, Robert Mugabe, and also Nelson Mandela. Of course, the latter coming from South Africa. People are talking about their leadership style, their past history, and their way of dealing with the power and their relationship eventually with the state. Do you think those two figures are comparable in any way?
Well, I don't think they are comparable because from the Mandela has been the worldwide recognition, the great man, and because one thing he is quite different with all other African leadership, that is, he stepped down voluntarily just by finishing the first term as the president, because he knows his age is high, and he knows that there are others maybe more capable, to run the economy, not himself, because he spent such a long time, like 27 years in jail, and he is the symbolic figure for leading the people, go through out of this apartheid regime. Right. But he knows himself. He also has the limitation. Maybe he cannot, doesn't know too much about the economic issue. Right. But for the Robert Mugabe, it's different. Even though both of them, they have led the people and then to get rid of those colonization and also like apartheid, but for the President Mugabe, and he stick to the power for such a long time, 37 years.
That's right.
And he always, even until today, he said he refused to step down. So too long time for the power, and even wants to pass this power to his wife. I think this is the thing eventually bring himself to this situation.
Right. You see, there's an ultimate issue of so-called the leadership of the revolution vis-a-vis the leadership of governance. Ms. Woods, you see those stories repeated in many different parts of the world. The power and the capacity issue, the greed, the ego, and also the selfishness of a politician should be. Ms. Woods, how is that reflected in this story? Very briefly from you.
Well, you know, I think we have had leaders, particularly in the African context, whether it's Patrice Lumumba in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, you have had Thomas Sankara in Burkina Faso, you have had leaders who came to power with the power of movements, of people, of popular movements supporting them, trade unions and faith-based groups across the board supporting them. And these leaders saw themselves as one with the masses, with the movements, with the people. I think Mugabe may have started out that way, and certainly Mandela was that way. But Mugabe, over time, you know, began to seek his own personal interests. And we don't have to look to the African context, right? It's in many countries around the world. Again, whether it's the United States where I am now or China and many other places where you see, you know, people seeking their own interests or the interests of their families at the expense of the people. Mm. And so I think it is because of this sense of inequality and injustice, as well as, you know, human rights violations and economic, concerns, that I think you have seen people really waiting to see what will happen with this transition in Zimbabwe today.
That's true. We are looking forward to see what's next. Emira Woods, He Wenping, thank you so much for being with us. Of course, our best wishes to the country and the people of Zimbabwe. Thank you.
Now, Russia has vetoed a U.S. draft resolution at the UN on extending the work of a joint probe into a deadly chemical incident in Syria earlier this year. Caleb Morpin looks at the story.
The meeting began with the United States putting forward a resolution to extend the work of the Joint Investigative Mechanism to continue its work looking into allegations in Syria. Well, the vote was taken, and Russia blocked it. As a permanent member of the Security Council, Russia blocked this resolution put forward by the United States. We then heard from Nikki Haley, the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, and she was not happy with Russia's move. This is what she said.
Russia has acted to obstruct these investigations many times, but today it strikes a deep blow. Russia has killed the Joint Investigative Mechanism, which has overwhelming support of this council. And by eliminating our ability to identify the attackers, Russia has undermined our ability to deter future attacks.
Now, later in the meeting, Russia and Bolivia were able to put forward a resolution that would have extended the work of the Joint Investigative Mechanism, but restricted it and urged it to operate in what they called a more reliant and scientific manner. And this resolution, put forward by Russia and Bolivia, was also vetoed. It was voted down at the Council. It was blocked by the United States. So this is what was said by the Russian ambassador to the United Nations. This was his response to Russia's proposed resolution to extend the investigation being blocked.
On the basis of an investigation which does not withstand scrutiny, is derived from evidence of unclear origin, and is falling apart like a house of cards, the Joint Investigative Mechanism has imposed a guilty sentence on the entire state of Syria.
Security Council meeting concluded with the investigation of the Joint Investigative Mechanism of the OPCW, the investigation into chemical weapons in Syria, going to expire. No extension was agreed upon. Now, this is in response to the chemical attack, the alleged chemical attack in Khan Shaykhun. 80 people were killed back in April with sarin nerve gas that was used in Khan Shaykhun. Now, when that chemical attack took place, the world had no evidence, no information had been gathered, but immediately we heard U.S. officials blame the Syrian government. The USA then unleashed 59 Tomahawk cruise missiles against a Syrian government airbase. This is what we heard from U.S. officials before any facts had even been gathered.
Well, Bolivia was the only country to join Russia in voting against the U.S. draft resolution at the Security Council. China and Egypt abstained. The Bolivian ambassador to the U.N., Sasha Laurenti, spoke exclusively to RT after the vote.
We voted against that resolution because that resolution didn't represent what we need for a joint mechanism to do. There were many, many members of the council that have stressed their concerns regarding how the joint investigative mechanism has been issuing its last report. We really believe that the investigation should be done in situ. So if we talk about the alleged attack in Khan Shaykhun, so the GIM, the joint investigative mechanism, should go to that place and to collect evidence in order to have a more transparent, independent, and complete investigation. There are different approaches to that, but I think there's a common ground. The common ground is that there should be investigations, and the ones that commit this kind of war crime should be held accountable. If the nations that are around that table, the one of the Security Council, are united, it means that there should be compromise, they should engage in negotiation, they should try to accommodate the interests of all of them.
Russian Justice Ministry has sent letters to two major US-funded media outlets and their subsidiaries too, notifying them that they may soon be designated as foreign agents. The move comes in response to RT being forced to register as a foreign agent in America. RT Samira Khan has the details.
Well, the new legislation targets U.S.-funded outlets, including Voice of America, Radio Free Europe, and its other regional branches. This comes only a few days after RT America was forced to register as a foreign agent or have all of their assets frozen. Russian RT have been regular topics of discussion at various hearings in the U.S., discussing alleged Russian interference in the 2016 election. But until this very day, there has been no evidence to substantiate any of these claims. Under the Foreign Agents Registration Act, RT America will now have to disclose its finances, provide regular reporting on its activities, all within 48 hours. They'll also have to add a disclaimer on all of its work. The ministry's latest decision is a mere response to Washington's recent crackdown on RT, and its measures are similar to those required under FARA, including disclosing finances and providing evidence of editorial independence. As news of Russia's response went global, Amnesty International was quick to react and released a statement on the issue, saying that the legislation strikes a serious blow to what was already a fairly desperate situation for press freedom in Russia. But the organization's concern wasn't extended to RT America when they were initially targeted by Washington. We reached out to several press freedom watchdogs for comment, and they didn't appear to be so outraged, to say the very least. Their responses ranged from not being informed on the topic to only being able to comment on non-domestic issues. But this is the first time that Russia has specified a list of companies that could possibly be designated as foreign agents, but we're actually still waiting for the official announcement.
Well, we discussed Russia's reaction with RT host Afshin Ratansi and also British journalist Neil Clark.
When we heard last week that RT had until the following Monday to register as a foreign agent in America, there was silence from groups like Amnesty and other groups that are supposed to be defending free speech and free media. And yet, when Russia very reasonably announces reciprocal measures in response to these measures from the US, then all of a sudden, these so-called impartial Western pro-human rights organizations come out and say, this is outrageous, this is terrible, Russia is clamping down on free speech. So really, it's very, very transparent. You only have to look at what's happened the last 5 days to see the rank hypocrisy.
Well, US authorities wanted a media war, and Russia's giving it right back to them. I presume that if Radio Free Europe and Voice of America are on this Russian list, one can only presume that the Russian Kremlin and the Russian government, they understand that these were well known as propaganda outlets well before this decision. So obviously it is tit for tat.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR, Community Public Radio. I'm your host, Don DeBar.